She patted her seated friend on the back. I'm going to steal him for a little while, okay?
You two kids be good, Hollis said.
There were other voices nearby, and Molly led him down the line of doorways and partitioned spaces toward the sound. At the end of this hall, they came to a large room with a diverse group of men and women sitting around a long conference table. On a second look, Noah saw that this furniture consisted of a mismatched set of folding chairs and four card tables butted end to end. The people inside had been listening to a speaker at the head of the table, but the room became quiet when they saw the newcomers. Everybody, Molly said, this is Noah Gardner. And Noah, these are some of the regional leaders of the Founders Keepers. You said you were good with names, so let's put you to the test. She started at the near end of the table and proceeded clockwise with introductions around the circle. Molly pointed out each person and gave the historic pseudonym that he or she had taken on when they joined the organization. Did you get all that? She asked. Let's see. He began where she'd ended and went around the other way. That's Patrick, Ethan, George, Thomas, Benjamin, Samuel, John, Alexander, James, Nathaniel, another Benjamin, Franklin or Rush, you didn't say which, Francis, William, and Stephen. Very good. I owe it all to Dale Carnegie. Each of the attendees had a book open, and from what he could see, they all appeared to be similar in every way but their visible contents. What did we interrupt? Noah asked. Is this a strategy session or something? Not tonight, Molly said. She motioned for the speaker at the head of the table to continue from where she'd left off. This woman, maybe 10 years Noah's senior, had been introduced as Thomas. Cherish, therefore, the spirit of our people, the woman said, and keep alive their attention. Do not be too severe upon their errors, but reclaim them by enlightening them. If once they become inattentive to the public affairs, you and I and Congress and assemblies, judges and governors shall all become wolves. These words were from the writings of Thomas Jefferson. Though Noah hadn't recognized them as such, he could see the heading in the open book of the one sitting next to her as she spoke. This man was following along carefully, tracking the memorized text with a moving fingertip. She was delivering the passage with feeling and energy, not as the rote recitation of a centuries-old letter, but as if, for the time being, she'd made Jefferson's thoughts her own. It seems to be the law of our general nature, she continued, in spite of individual exceptions, and experience declares that man is the only animal which devours his own kind. For I can apply no milder term to the governments of Europe and to the general prey of the rich on the poor. There was an empty chair at the table with one of those little books in front of it. Molly picked up this book and waved a goodbye to the others as they prepared for the next speaker in line. She took Noah's hand and led him from the room and back up the hall again. Aren't they going to need that book? Noah asked. No, this one's mine. She handed it to him. I'm not like they are, though. They've each memorized a whole person, and I've just got little pieces of a lot of them. Mostly Thomas Paine, though. So, what's the meaning of all this? The book was clearly hand-bound and not mass-manufactured. It looked old but well cared for, and there was a number on the inside front cover, suggesting that this one and the others were part of a large series. It's one of the things the Founders Keepers do, Molly said. We remember. You remember speeches and letters and things? We remember how the country was founded. You never know. We might have to do it again someday. So you keep it in your heads? Why? In case all the history books get burned? It's already happening, Noah, if you haven't noticed. Not burning, but changing. Ask an elementary school kid what they know about George Washington, and it's more likely you'll hear the lies about him, like the cherry tree story, or that he had wooden dentures, than about anything that really made him the founder of our country. Ask a kid in high school about Ronald Reagan, and they'll probably tell you that he was a B-list actor turned politician, or that he was the guy who happened to be in office when Gorbachev ended the Cold War. Ask a college kid about Social Security, and they'll probably tell you it was intended to provide guaranteed retirement income for all Americans. Ask a 30-year-old about World War II, and they'll recite what they remember from Saving Private Ryan. Do you see? No one really needs to rewrite history. They just have to make sure that no one remembers it. He closed the book carefully and gave it back to her. Molly?
Yes?
Hit me with a little Thomas Paine. She took his hand and spoke quietly as they walked.
These are the times that try men's souls, Molly said. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated.
Back in Molly's section of the loft, she gave Noah his iced tea and took a seat on the edge of her hammock. He sat on a nearby divan made from crates, a simple frame and random cushions. The tea turned out to be as sweet as she'd warned it would be, but it was good.
That looked like a small arsenal Hollis had back there, Noah said. Are all those guns legal?
Two of them are registered. The rest are just passing through. He's on his way to a gun show upstate.
So the answer's no, they're not legal.
Do you know what it took to make those two guns legal in this city?
I can imagine.
It took over a year, and the guy who owns them had to get fingerprinted, interviewed, and charged about $1,000 to exercise a constitutional right.
Welcome to New York. There's a lot you've got to live with when you live here.
Wait, didn't you say you were pre-law in college? I would have thought they'd have spent a few minutes on the Second Amendment.
Yeah, they did, Noah said. The experts differ quite a bit on its interpretation.
She spoke the words thoughtfully. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
That seems pretty clear to me.
You left out the part that causes all the arguments.
The word militia meant something different back then, Noah. Ben Franklin started the first one here. The militia was every citizen who was ready and able to protect their community, whatever the threat. It was as natural as having a lock on your front door. Today the police are there to protect society, but they're not obligated to protect you and me as individuals. The Supreme Court's ruled on that quite a few times, and they certainly won't protect us from the government, God forbid it would ever come to that. So the way I read it, the Second Amendment simply says we have the right to be ready to defend ourselves and our neighbors if we have to.
Speaking of the way you read it, he said, why don't you tell me about your bookshelf there?
She looked over at it briefly.
What about it?
I was noticing some of the titles. That's quite a subversive library.
People use some of those books to smear us, and some of them were written by our enemies. I read everything so I'll know what I'm up against and how to talk about them. You don't see any harm in that, do you?
Who's this Ragnar Benson lunatic?
She smiled. He's not a lunatic. That's a pen name, by the way. Hardly anyone knows who he really is. He writes about a lot of useful things, though.
Like how to make a grenade launcher in your rumpus room?
That one was from his mercenary days. He's mellowed out some since then. Now he's more about independence and readiness and self-sufficiency, you know? The joys of living off the grid.
It almost sounds like you know this guy.
She considered him for a moment and then leaned closer. Can you keep a secret?
This is probably the wrong day to ask me that.
It's Hollis's uncle, Molly whispered. And guess who took up the family business and wrote a few of those books himself?
Hollis? He pointed over his shoulder with a thumb. My Hollis?
She nodded, smiling a little. You shouldn't judge a person by appearances, you know. He's a very smart man.
Yeah, so is the Unabomber. Top of his class, I hear.
You make little jokes when you're nervous, Molly said. That's kind of cute.
Thanks.
Now finish your tea, or I'll think you don't like it.
He did, in one long drink, and Molly patted a place beside her on the hammock with one hand. Oh, no, he said. I've lived 28 years without trying to get into one of those. You sit over here with me.
Come on, it's easy, chicken.
It'll flip over.
No, it won't.
She held out her hands to him, beckoning.
I just want to forget about everything else for a little while, okay? Come here now. Don't make me ask you again.
It would have been hard to say no to that, and he didn't try. With her guidance, he sat next to her on the precarious edge of the hammock.
Now we just hold on, Molly said. Let your feet come off the floor and lie down, and try not to roll off the other side.
He followed her lead as she leaned back, and from there it was a touch-and-go funhouse ride for quite a few wobbly seconds. Amid the swinging and shifting and overbalancing and a great deal of welcome laughter, things gradually settled down into a fragile stability. In the end, they found themselves pleasantly entwined with one another, held close in the pocket of the hammock in a comfortable, gentle sway. There was no ceiling to the enclosure of her room, and high overhead among the distant steel beams, someone had arrayed several dim strings of white Christmas lights in a pattern reminiscent of a starry evening sky.
Hey, Molly, he whispered. Yes? What do you say we just stay here like this for a really long time?
She held him a little closer.
I wish we could.
He'd noticed her silver bracelet before, but now it was close enough to see the marks of its worn engraving. What does this say? She brought her wrist closer to his eyes.
It's been through a lot, and I'm afraid it's getting a little hard to read.
Noah held her hand and found the right distance and the proper angle in the dim light to allow him to make out the faded lettering. When he was sure of what they said, he read the words aloud. We have it in our power to begin the world over again.
That's right, Molly said.
Whose quote is that? I've heard it before.
Thomas Paine.
He laid his head back down next to hers.
But how do you think you can do that, Molly? I'm not saying you can't, but I don't see how. There's more, she said.
With her other hand, she carefully twisted the bracelet so the inner face of it turned out, and there was another inscription on that side. Faith, hope, charity.
That's nice. Nice?
I guess I don't really understand, Noah said. I mean, I understand those words, but that's not really a battle plan, is it?
Do you know what you're up against?
Yes, Molly said. But I doubt that our enemies do. So tell me.
Okay, Molly said. Pop quiz. Who fired the first shot in the American Revolution?
That's a trick question. Nobody knows who fired the first shot.
Is that your final answer?
Yep. She worked herself up onto an elbow so she could look at him.
It wasn't fired from a gun. The first shot was a sermon delivered by Jonathan Mayhew years before Lexington and Concord. It wasn't a politician who first said no taxation without representation. It was a preacher.
Ah, so that's the faith part.
It's more than that. Our rights come from a higher power, Noah. Men can't grant them, and men can't take them away. That's the difference, I think, between what happened in the French Revolution and what we achieved in ours. We believed we had the will of God behind us, and they believed in the words of Godwin. One endures, and the other fell to human weakness.
He touched the second word engraved in her silver bracelet. And what about hope?
That means we believe in the strongest part of the human spirit. Hope and truth are tied together. If everything we know is a lie, we don't have a chance. When a doctor tells you you're sick, you don't blame her for the diagnosis. You have the truth, then, no matter how bad it is, and you can make a plan to get better. That's hope, to know that even when things look darkest, there can be a better day tomorrow. Molly pointed out the last word of the three. And charity is simple. We believe that it's up to each of us to help one another get to that better tomorrow. Ben Franklin explained my whole bracelet when the president of Yale asked him to sum up the American religion. He answered, that there is a God, and that there is life after this one, and he will hold us accountable for our actions in this life, and that the best way to serve him is to serve our fellow man. That's faith, hope, and charity.
It sounds good.
Noah adjusted a pillow and laid his head back onto it. I hate to say it, though. I just don't think it's enough.
Maybe it's not something you get right away, Molly said. It didn't come to any of us overnight. When you're ready to understand, you'll understand.
A sketch on white paper was attached to the wall at their side, placed so it would be easily visible to someone lying where they were.
"Who drew that over there?" Noah asked.
She turned her head that way, rolled over slightly, reached out to tug the paper free from its pushpin, and then held it so they both could see.
"I did."
It was a drawing of a small log cabin in a valley in wintertime, near a stream within a secluded patch of woods. The details of the place were carefully rendered. A porch swing, a spot for a garden to the side within a low split-rail fence, a path of flat stones to the front steps, puffs of drifted snow on the eaves and windowsills. It was only simple lines and shades from the edge of a pencil, but the scene was fondly captured there in the artist's sensitive hand.
"It's really beautiful," Noah said. "Where is this?"
"Only in my head, I guess."
She looked at him.
"And you want to know something?"
"Sure."
"This is all I want, really. This little place. I imagine that makes me sound pretty simple to someone like you."
"No, it doesn't. It sounds good."
"Just a place like this to share with someone, and the freedom to live our lives there. The pursuit of happiness, you know? That means a different thing to everybody, and that's the way it should be. But this is mine. This is what I dream about."
"I hope you get there someday."
"I hope we all do."
He thought for a moment.
"Why don't you just go out right now and find that place?"
"You mean why don't I just grab mine while I can and to hell with everybody else?"
"That's not exactly what I meant."
"There's a cancer in our country, Noah. We've both seen the X-rays now. If we don't stop it, it'll spread wherever we try to hide, and I want you to know something. I need for you to know something."
"Okay."
"There's nothing I wouldn't give up to defend my country. No matter how hard it might be, there's nothing that's in my power that I wouldn't do."
"I understand," Noah said. "I admire that a lot."
"But I don't want this on my shoulders. I don't want to be right. I wish things were different. If I could, I'd stay here just like this, like you said."
"I just wish I felt that strongly about anything."
Quiet minutes passed. And as he lay there, gazing up at those imitation stars, feeling her close to him, he tried without much success to remember exactly what it was he'd been pursuing for all these years, if it wasn't a simple togetherness, just like this. Then he noticed a subtle blur that had crept into his vision. A little shimmer had formed around sources of light, and though he blinked it away, the strange haze returned after a moment more, this time accompanied by an odd discomfort, like a passing wave of vertigo.
"Whoa. What is it?"
"Nothing. I think I got the whirlies there for a second."
No sooner had the feeling left than it came over him again, but stronger this time, and he stiffened, tried to shake it off. Molly raised herself on an elbow beside him, concern in her eyes.
"Are you okay?"
"Yeah," he breathed out. "I'm fine."
But he wasn't fine. There'd been a time in college after a stupid drinking game when he'd downed far too much of the spiked punch too quickly, and all that alcohol had hit his bloodstream at once. It had been the worst feeling of helplessness, because by the time he realized his mistake, there was nothing he could do to stop what was coming.
"I need to get up," he said.
His own words were slow to reach his ears, and they didn't sound right. A flutter of panic was beginning to take hold inside, and he felt her cool hand on his forehead, comforting.
"Be still now," she said.
But it had almost all drained away by then, first the strength and then the will to move, all replaced by this building sensation of a slow-motion backward swoon at the sheer edge of a bottomless ravine. As the cloudy room began to swim and fade, he saw that three strangers were standing nearby, young men dressed in business suits and ties. "It's time to go, Molly," one of them said, the voice far away and unreal.
"Just give us a minute. Wait for me downstairs."
And they were gone, and another taller figure appeared.
"You'll stay with him, Hollis, won't you?"
"I'll stay just as long as I can."
He felt her arms around him tight, her tears on his cheek, her lips near his ear as the blackness finally, fully descended. Almost gone, but the three simple words she'd whispered to him then would stay clear in his mind even after everything else had faded away into the dark.
"I'm so sorry."
Chapter 22. Agent Kearns had retired to the kitchenette of his double-wide mobile home to make breakfast. This left Danny Bailey sitting by himself in the parlor in his borrowed pajamas, with a wicked sleep hangover, an ugly off-white cat, and a full-scale model of a small atomic bomb. The Sunday news from some distant city lay folded at the far end of the couch. It would have been nice to see some headlines, but the paper was a little too close to the cat to be safely retrieved.
"So, you've never been to Winnemucca, you said," Kearns called through the narrow doorway.
Again with the frickin' small talk.
"No, can you believe that?" Danny said.
He was looking over the elaborate cylindrical device in its heavy wooden cradle on the coffee table.
"Never knew what I was missing." "If you think this burg is dead, wait until you see where we're going to meet these guys tonight. This whole part of Nevada was voted the official armpit of America by the Washington Post a couple of years ago."
"Sounds like a hoot. Hey, Stuart?"
"Yeah?"
"I don't want to come off like a puss, but is this bomb-looking thing, like, radioactive?"
"Nah, not too much."
Kearns returned with their coffee and sat in a nearby chair.
"The core's inert. It's just a big ball of lead. There's some depleted uranium under the lining, so it'll set off a Geiger counter in case anybody checks. Here, look."
He flipped a switch on a boxy yellow gadget on the table and brought its wand closer to an open access panel at the fore end of the model. The meter on the instrument twitched, and a rapid clicking from its speaker ramped up to a loud, raspy buzz as the tip of the wand touched an inner metal housing.
"Sure sounds hot enough, though, doesn't it?"
"But it's not dangerous."
"Ah, but I wouldn't keep it under my bed at night."
"And these dudes we're going to see, the boys who want to buy this thing, why would they ever believe that a private citizen could get his hands on a working nuclear weapon?"
"Okay, good. We should talk about this. You remember about a year ago, there was a story in the news about a live cruise missile that went missing."
"Of course I do. The Barksdale thing. I did a whole week of shows on that. Somebody screwed up and loaded real warheads instead of dummies onto a B-52 in North Dakota. 6 nukes left the base, but only 5 showed up in Louisiana."
"Right," Kearns said. "Now we both know that something like that can't just happen. Not as an accident, anyway. It's like the Secret Service accidentally putting the president into the wrong car and then nobody missing him until noon the next day. It's impossible. There are way too many safeguards in place. Unless, of course, it was an inside job. So, my online personality is a guy with tons of deep connections from my years with the FBI.
About 7 years ago, I finally got disgusted with the whole crooked government, slipped off the reservation, and disappeared into my own version of the Witness Protection Program. My cover story was that to get this bomb, I made friends with the right two people on those munitions crews through my website, one at Minot Air Force Base and one at the destination. They fudged the orders and arranged that flight, then helped me get the guts of one of those warheads onto a truck and on its way out of Barksdale half a day before anybody even knew it was missing.
So you're not trying to claim you built this from scratch, like in your backyard workshop?
No, hell no, of course not. Just the mount and the housing, and I hooked up some of the electronics. That's all I had to put together here. The warhead itself was intact.
Danny leaned forward and ran a fingertip along one of the smoother welds.
I've got to hand it to you. It looks pretty badass.
Yeah, it does,
Kearns said, as he stowed the Geiger counter in a gym bag next to the couch. If I do say so myself.
And how much of that's actually true?
How much of what is actually true?
What you just said. That whole Barksdale story.
Kearns didn't answer right away. He zipped up the bag on the floor and then sat back in his chair, frowning.
What is this, 60 Minutes all of a sudden?
No, man, we're just talking.
I'm not here to fill in the blanks for your next conspiracy video.
I'm just trying to get our story straight.
Okay, Kearns said. But what's true or not true about what I just said isn't part of the story. You've got to get straight.
Fine, okay, sorry. It just sounded so believable. This is all pretty new to me, you know, and I'm still a little groggy this morning. I haven't slept for 12 hours like that in 20 years.
The other man continued to study him, as if he felt he might have made a slip and was still assessing its severity. But after a few seconds, he nodded, seemed to ease down a bit, and pulled the reluctant, rumpled cat a little closer and rubbed its head.
Yeah, okay, Kearns said. Sorry, I didn't mean to get my dander up. Maybe I'm getting a little paranoid in my old age. I've been told in the past I've got some issues.
Hey, pal, who doesn't, right?
You said it.
The microwave in the other room beeped at the end of its heating cycle.
So, Danny said, rubbing his hands together, what's to eat?
Agent Kearns brought in some toast and a crusty tub of margarine, along with some scrambled eggs and ham from a can. The meat was spongy and slick, and the eggs tasted like survival food, but with enough salt and pepper, it all became passable enough.
I only asked what I asked before, Danny said, because I would have thought you guys had all kinds of labs and engineers back at headquarters that would have built a model like this for an undercover operation, you know, so someone like you wouldn't have to bother with any of it yourself.
Yeah, they do, but these last few years I've gotten accustomed to working alone. The less contact you make when you're undercover, the safer it is. Hell, I've been out in the cold so long on this one, as far as I know, only one guy inside even knows I'm still on the payroll.
Wow. You must really trust that guy.
Kearns bent and slipped a snub-nosed revolver from his ankle holster, matter-of-factly, as if it had been just a pebble stuck in his shoe. He swung out the cylinder and spun it with the flat of his hand, flicked it back into place, laid the gun on his side of the table, and then picked up his plate to resume his breakfast. You'd almost think all this had nothing to do with the subject at hand.
Sure, kid, Kearns said. I trust everybody.
Chapter 23 Sunday afternoon was spent with each of them going over the other's public background. If they were to appear to be old acquaintances, they couldn't hesitate on some obvious detail that might come up in the conversation. Then, before loading up the van, they'd made a telephone call to finalize the evening's meet-up with the targets of the sting operation. Kearns had used a hacker gizmo called an orange box to fake the caller ID display the recipients would see. It would appear to them as though the call had come directly from Danny Bailey's private number. His actual cell phone was apparently still stuck in the bowels of some evidence warehouse back in New York. The man who'd answered had been suitably impressed to be talking to one of his longtime media heroes in the war against tyranny. The time and address of the meeting were confirmed, and Stuart Kearns was heartily endorsed as a verified patriot who could absolutely deliver the goods. Before sign-off, the man on the other end had handed the phone around so everyone could have a moment to speak with their celebrity caller. Under Kern's watchful eye, Danny had played along with it all quite easily, but something began to nag at him after they'd hung up. The troubling thing was that, though each of those men had laid claim to being his biggest fan, and had seen every video he'd ever produced and read every word he'd ever posted online, they'd all apparently seen and heard and read things that Danny Bailey was pretty sure he'd never actually said. That the only way left to rally the people was to rip aside the curtain and force the enemy out into the light of day. That the globalist oligarchs and their puppets in Washington had been spoiling for a fight for 60 years, and now they were going to get the war that was coming to them. That the souls of the founders were crying out for true patriots to step up and set things right with the Republic, and that the time had finally come for a 21st-century shot heard round the world, the final trumpet to signal the start of the second American Revolution. But even if not in precisely those words, those sentiments did sound awfully familiar. Maybe he had said such things, and it was only the current context that put them into such a stark new light. After all, things can sound different when echoed back by men who've decided to deliver their message with a 15-kiloton city killer instead of with a bullhorn. Chapter 24. They'd been rolling down a desolate, moonless stretch of Interstate 80 for a number of miles. The road was so dark that the world out front seemed to end at the reach of the headlights, and there was nothing to see at all out the window behind.
"Hey, Stuart?"
"Yeah?"
"I wouldn't be doing this if I agreed with these hoodlums, even 1%. I'm not a terrorist, and I'm not a turncoat."
"I didn't think you were," Kern said, his eyes on the road.
"Like I said before, these aren't my people, and what they want to do isn't the way to change things, and I've never said it was."
"I believe you."
For once, a little mindless conversation would have been welcome, but since no chit-chat was forthcoming from the driver's seat, Danny had to occupy himself with his own thoughts, listening to the sound of the road beneath the wheels. "What kind of a phone is that?" Danny asked. He'd noticed the device before, held in its charger near the center console. It was too big to be a cell phone. It looked more like a smaller, thinner version of a walkie-talkie, but with a standard keypad.
"Satellite phone," Kern said. "Works anywhere. Cell phone coverage in a place like this is pretty spotty."
"I guess it would be." After a while, Kearns let his foot off the gas, and the van began to coast and slow down as he reached forward to shut off the headlights. "What are you doing?"
"Roll down your window, stick out your head, and look up," Kearns said.
"Why would I want to do that?"
"Just trust me. I want you to see something. You live in the city, right?"
"Yeah, downtown Chicago," Danny said. "Just about all my life."
He cranked the glass down, leaned his head out into the cold wind, and looked up as he'd been directed.
"Well, there's only about 3 things to see out here in the middle of nowhere," Kern said. "But this is one of them."
Oh, my God. The air was perfectly clear, it seemed, from the barren ground all the way out to the edge of space. From horizon to horizon, there was no man-made light to obscure the view up above. Thousands of stars, maybe tens of thousands of them, were shining up there like backlit jewels in a dark velvet dome. Sprays of tiny pinpoints in subtle colors, blazing white suns in orderly constellations arrayed across the heavens, ageless by the measure of a human lifetime, all light years away, but seeming to be almost near enough to reach out and touch. Danny pulled his head back in, sat back, and rolled up the window as Kearns flipped the headlights back on and turned up the heater to warm up the van again.
"Thanks, man. Really. I was sitting over here in dire need of some perspective."
"Sort of puts a guy in his place, doesn't it?" Kearns said. "That's where we all came from, out there. And someday, that's where we're all going back."
You know, I saw it on your business card, but now I understand why they call you a special agent.
Well, son, whether you want me to or not, I'm going to take that as a compliment.
A few miles farther on, Kearns exited and soon after turned onto a dirt road. The road meandered for a mile or so between barbed wire fences on either side until they came to an even narrower gravel path. Halfway down that driveway, they saw the yellowish lights of a ranch house.
"This is it," Kearns said. "You all set?"
Danny took in a deep breath and let it relax the tension out of him as he exhaled.
"Yeah. Let's do this thing."
The garage door was up, and from their parking spot, Danny could clearly see the men seated around a couple of card tables, surrounded by stacks of stored junk, auto parts, and red tool cases. That all turned when the headlights swung across the wide-open doorway, and upon recognizing the vehicle, they motioned for their guests to come on in. Kearns stayed in the van as Danny got out and walked up the paved incline toward the house, his hands clearly open at his sides in an effort to let everyone know that he wasn't armed. Evidently, these guys had no such concern. They met him halfway up the sidewalk to the garage and greeted him like he was a long-lost friend. There was only one thing amiss. He and Kearns had come expecting to see all five men at this meeting, and one of them wasn't there. Chapter 25. The gathering got right down to business. It had been all talk up to this point, Danny told them, but now this thing had gotten real. Stuart Kearns had what they wanted, so the only question that remained was whether he'd truly found the right men for the job. There would be only one shot at this, a strike that had been years in the planning, so a lot was riding on the proper makeup of this team. Danny took a printout from his pocket, a transcript of the most recent chat room conversation, and matched up the four men with their screen names. The fifth, he was told, a guy named Elmer, had taken an unexpected trip